everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back for our second episode on the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And how are you feeling about that, bitch?
Wow. You know, I was listening to the end of last episode to remind me, just to remind me once more, which films, like, where did we cut it off? Which ones are we going to focus on? Which ones are we going to talk about tangentially? And which ones are we going to deep dive? And I heard myself saying, it's not bad homework, guys. It's not going to suck. Like, this isn't going to be bad for you. It felt kind of bad for me.
Yeah, I think the latter part of this franchise is definitely more shaky than the original three films. And I knew that going in. I had a couple pleasant surprises on rewatching some of these.
Mm-hmm.
Some not so nice surprises with some of them.
Yeah.
But I think there's so much to talk about. And it's something that we've danced around and touched on in different episodes about the kind of economics that go behind a franchise like this and the marketing and the promotion and how all of these things kind of flow together.
I agree. I'm going to get rid of the dog, BRB. So, Nightmare on Elm Street, we're looking at an 8-movie franchise, plus one if you count Freddy vs. Jason, plus another one if you count the remake, which we're going to touch on really briefly toward the end. That's coming in second of my horror franchise list. I've got Friday the 13th as 10, plus one for including Freddy vs. Jason. Halloween has 7, but I just realized that I didn't include, I think Phantasm is at probably 7 or 8, and then there's Saw.
There's Saw, there's Hellraiser. Hellraiser is a shit ton.
Yeah.
I think it's not uncommon for some of these franchises to go on and on. And I think the period we're going to talk about today, the late 80s, saw this kind of boom of all of these franchises and sequels. And they went very quickly from being popular and entertaining to people getting sick and deriding the horror genre because of them.
Right.
Because they were seen as such cash grabs and mm-hmm. such cheap product as this, that, and the other. And, you know, while I have favorites among the bunch of these films, I think there are bits and pieces you can pull out of even your least favorite film to say, like, hey, here's something cool. Here's something new. Here's what it did to the genre. Here's what it was reacting to. And I think that's really the basis of Faculty of Horror and what we like to do here.
Yeah.
So, you know, for anyone who says horror films aren't political, don't know why you're listening to this podcast unless you're open-minded.
Yeah, just read my editorial for next issue, as a matter of fact. Yeah, but I think it's also worth mentioning that, you know, the 80s were really a heyday for this. And once again, hearkening back to that Never Sleep Again documentary, you'll hear them talking about these sequels and about how, you know, they had a release date before they even had a script. And in one of the cases, I think they were shooting right up until 2 weeks before it had to be released. Like, that is crazy. That is not a good template for making a film. Plus, there was the writer's strike. We're going to get into all that. But it's also worth mentioning that in the past 5 to 10 years, there's been a bit of a shift in how we approach sequels. Like, not only are we seeing more entries that share the same universe, I'm making quotation hands here for those of you who can't see me, which is all of you except for Alex, without the burden of having very much to do with one another. And furthermore, some franchises are just like ignoring their own content and happening concurrently. Like, I don't even know what's going on with Spider-Man and X-Men right now. Like, they seem to have rebooted and rebooted within the last 10 years.
Yeah, and that's to do with film companies failing or getting bought out and properties getting, like, reabsorbed basically just into Disney. And that's the case. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of superhero movies right now. And something we're going to get a little taste of later on in this franchise when they try to introduce new characters and the politics and the finances that go into that, because it is a huge financial decision.
Mm-hmm. And for Nightmare on Elm Street in particular, New Line Cinema is the house that Freddy built. Like, you can't talk about Nightmare without talking about that company and its trials and tribulations. So, should we get into it?
Let's do it. And I think in our conversations between Andrea and myself, we've kind of divvied up this episode into two chunks. So I'm going to summarize the first chunk of films, which includes Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Nightmare on Elm Street 5, and Nightmare on Elm Street 6, Freddy's Dead. So let's do it.
I want to draw some blood.
No!
So, 1988's Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Dream Master. After being brought back to life by dog piss, Freddy returns to finish his work against the remaining Dream Warriors, but comes up against Alice, who has the powerful ability passed on from Kristen to bring people into her dreams, and she can also use her powers and ability against Freddy.
Now no one sleeps!
Scoot over about a year later to 1989's Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child. Alice from the previous film becomes pregnant, and Freddy tries to be reborn via her fetus, who appears to her as a 6-year-old child, Jacob, who they kind of fight Freddy together.
It's a boy!
Cut ahead another couple years to 1991's Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. Freddy sends the only remaining teen in Springwood into the world to bring him more victims. And this teen, known as John Doe, returns with troubled teens from a shelter and their therapist, Maggie. Maggie is revealed to be the daughter of Freddy, and Maggie kills Freddy by pulling him into the real world and out of the dreamscape.
Now I'm playing with power!
So, those are those films. I know I'm not doing them justice in terms of a plot summary, but we're giving them the due that I think the writers and the lack of writers and the people who had time to create these films had. And I think what we're seeing in these films and what we're going to talk about with them is that they weren't these, you know, narrative epics that hinged on various ideas. They have some really interesting ideas within them, mm-hmm. And some really great moments within them, but they were kind of pieced together to sell film, to sell the movies, and to profit off of this character of Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as I mentioned before, there was a writer's strike happening. So there were literal hurdles to having a proper screenwriter work up a script for these. So from the looks of things, they really leaned into the special effects. We're going to talk about MTV and its influence on this franchise and just making this franchise as creative and bombastic and crazy as it could be. Just now in hearing you do the synopsis, I can almost hear through the trajectory of the sequels that they tried something and it didn't work. So they tried to kind of go back into the first three films and pluck out this element that worked back there and try to work that in. But again, that didn't work. You get the sense that they're trying to capture lightning in a bottle again and again and again.
Yeah, it's they've got a few stables of things they want to play with. So, you know, I think a lot of people, myself included, I'm going to personally forgive myself for getting some of these movies confused.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are some kills that I thought happened in an earlier entry or some that happened in a later entry. And so rewatching them all in pretty quick succession was pretty eye-opening, mm-hmm. in terms of what each one was trying to do and the means and the ways they tried to do it. I think one of the things that these films struggle with a lot is this desire and this notion to return to Freddy as scary.
Freddy as scary, likable kids that you root for.
Yeah, going back to all of the things that made the original a success. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, you know, there's a lot of conjecture, and I even felt it a bit in the Never Sleep Again documentary of people going like, oh, you know, they did this in the past films, but this one was going to be different for X, Y, and Z, mainly by returning to something from the original film,
right.
or an idea or playing with something from that sandbox. But it's hard. It's hard to do that because the mythology, the trajectory, the finances were so unwieldy that they couldn't quite nail it, in
That's
my
right.
opinion.
Yeah. And even like the most successful franchises of all time are up and down. Sometimes they're just up and up. Like Mission Impossible has been pretty consistently performing very well at the box office. Harry Potter, I don't watch these films, but I hear they're amazing. Star Wars, up and down. Fast and Furious, up, up, up. So anything can happen with these. And trying to recreate the original is an impossible task. But anyway, let's talk about what these films did for better or for worse.
For me, one of the big takeaways from this kind of chunk of films, and they're very explicit about it, particularly when they talk about Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Dream Master, is the influence of MTV. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good place to start in terms of understanding how this, you know, petri dish of Freddy was created. Mm-hmm. So a quick refresher, that MTV stood for once the music TV.
Oh,
it did. Before the Hills. It was about music, apparently. But that launched in 1981, and it was predominantly music videos, and it was designed to appeal to youth culture, and it eventually became a content creator with mm-hmm. things like The Real World and then spinning off into Laguna Beach and, again, The Hills. I watched a lot of The Hills when I was in my early 20s.
Me too, actually.
Yeah?
That one. Oh, yeah. I still like reality TV. I find it fascinating, and I think it's fascinating that MTV had that trajectory and that it was just on what the kids want, what the kids were doing. And so I think anyone who's interested in youth culture, MTV's trajectory is just...
It's so important.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, MTV was designed to sell things. It was a conglomerate of Warner, and they bought up properties to basically sell commercial time. Mm-hmm. You know, so this was in partnership with things like Nickelodeon for kids.
Right.
But, you know, with MTV, it was, I think, they weren't expecting it to take off as much as it did. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of an influence of a couple different things. So directors, young directors getting their start with music videos, musicians like Madonna and Michael Jackson, even to artists like Metallica, were able to create a visual representation of what they did. And I think for someone like Madonna, who I do really like, but she's not the strongest singer, she may not have the best songs all of the time, but she created a visual iconography for herself.
Yes.
That was interesting, that was unique, that was rebellious, that people really, really responded to. And what we've seen in the 80s is careers built on this kind of cultural iconography.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And MTV also, by virtue of its showing music videos, it was kind of the first channel to show this really like short form content. You know, there'd be a stream of music videos and sometimes they'd be kind of clumped into shows from what I recall. I have more experience with the Canadian version.
Much music,
which was right here out of Toronto and was its thing. I don't know that it's still around, is it?
It is still around.
Really?
Yeah.
In the same capacity?
Barely.
Now, you'll remember when we talked about Assassination Nation, about how, like, the director tried to capture the frenetic energy of a Twitter feed, this attention deficit disorder onslaught of you're going to be distracted in a second. Tune into MTV if you've got 5 minutes to spare and you'll get this little nugget of content. That's something that has changed but is still the case, and that's something that sociologists have bemoaned, that people have been like, oh, you know, like the youth culture, they have no attention span and they have no focus. And when we talk about the MTV generation, I often hear it referred to in kind of a pejorative mm-hmm. way like that.
Well, and I think this is something that is still lobbed against youth culture to this day, is
yes.
the short attention span. They're always on social media.
Yeah.
It's this, that, and the other. And it's, you know, it's just new technology. It's new ways of communicating. And I think as your brain is developing, you're looking for these kind of like sharp shocks that kind of pull your interest. Mm-hmm. And I think MTV really succeeded in that. And it was a way of bringing a kind of homogeny to mm-hmm. culture. So you could be a kid in a penthouse in New York City, or you could be a kid in rural Alabama and still be getting the same kind of cultural experience by engaging with MTV if you were able to.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of the shortened attention span thing that people like to lob against MTV, it was also criticized for popularizing dark topics like sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Mm.
And, you know, the rise of people like Alice Cooper, mm-hmm. Things like that, people like that, rather. People got really scared, and they got really scared that their kids could consume it so easily.
Oh, that's right. This was like the age of satanic panic, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Freddie was part of this. He was on MTV, particularly around the time of the release of Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and he was doing little spots with VJs. He was popping up. He was, you know, scaring the VJs and talking shit to them and calling them bitch, you know, and he was seen as this kind of fun guy.
Yeah.
So even for kids who hadn't necessarily consumed the first film or were of age to consume the first film, they understood this guy is kind of a jokester or trickster.
Yeah.
Who would like fuck with the guy on TV and make him panic or make him feel weird. And I think this marriage between Freddie and MTV, not only through the style of the film that Rennie Harlan, the director, tried to make, and he's quite open about wanting to make an MTV-style film.
Mm-hmm.
And he also cites the Hong Kong strong action film as another influence. But the MTV one just feels so prevalent. So Freddie became kind of a rock god. Again, he was in line with, you know, Marilyn Manson, with Kiss, with this kind of dark rock culture that people were beginning
shock
to
rockers.
Idolize. Exactly, shock rockers that people were idolizing. And some New Line aligned him with that. So this is where you begin to see that transition from Freddie as child killer, maybe pedophile molester, but to a fun, kind of cool guy that the people would root for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his ubiquity really can't be understated. Like, even when I was doing research, it's like I'm looking through academic journals and looking through the term Freddy Krueger, and he's just used for movies. He's just used for, like, scary movies. It might not have anything to do with Freddy Krueger, but he's, like, achieved that ubiquity that transcends the genre, which is really pretty singular. I think I'm going to want to talk about this a little more as that subject is addressed in New Nightmare. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I can't think of a whole lot of the horror icons who have quite achieved that level.
No, and I think it has to do with the fact that Freddy is very verbal as a character, or could be verbal. They could make him verbal. Mm-hmm. Like, if all of a sudden Michael Myers started talking, that would be weird.
Oh, yeah.
That would feel so intrinsically wrong to the spirit of those films, whichever film you follow in that cinematic universe. But I think it also kind of played into something else that I was noticing on the rewatch of all these films is Freddy as trend follower. Not Freddy as trend setter, but he was someone who could engage with trends at the time, whether that be the fitness craze, whether it be video games, comic books, things like that. So you'll see specifically designed kills, in particularly these three films, that are trying to address something to do with youth culture. I mean, I do really like Robert Englund. I think he's really smart. I think he's quite funny. But there's a part in the Never Sleep Again doc where he's talking about how, I think in Freddy's Dead, they make the first gamer joke. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, did you also invent, like, comedy and humor?
Calm down.
Like, yeah. Love you, but calm down.
Yeah, that was something they kind of introduced in 3, and then the franchise really leaned into, is the fact that if Freddy's able to get into these kids' dreams, he can make very specific kills, and that can really incite creativity. And with regard to creativity, I mean, we're talking about Rennie Harlan in Nightmare on Elm Street 4. The fact that he got that gig, and this is like, these at this point, these movies are doing so well at the box office, right? You would think that New Line has their pick of the litter when it comes to people to lead these, but they gave these gigs to upstarts, to mavericks, to creative people who are like, I want to do something different. And I think that's something that's really cool about this franchise and about the Dream Master.
And also, first-time directors or new directors are usually pretty cheap.
Uh-huh. And Rennie Harlan was not hard on the eyes. Once again, refer back to that documentary.
All right. Well, he did marry Gina Davis.
Did he really?
Yeah, they were married for a bit, yeah, in the 90s.
Before or after Jeff Goldblum?
After.
Oh, rough gig. So between the Dog Pee resurrection and killing off the surviving Elm Street kids in the first 10 minutes, like, I think to fans who really love Nightmare 3, it's easy to get your back up and be like, he is just dispensing with what came before. But I feel like I can't blame him for that. And I'm saying that as somebody who has come in on a gig where there has been tremendous precedent set, but you want to have your own kick at the can. You want to make it different. You want to make it yours. And I think for New Line to have hired Rennie and for Rennie to have made this MTV nightmare, I don't think it was a bad play.
No, and I think the fact that Patricia Arquette didn't return, it just already feels kind of separate and a bit different from the spirit of Dream Warriors. But I will say the interesting thing for me about Nightmare on Elm Street 4 is I do think it's actually quite well directed. And for me, the most successful moments, either narratively or emotionally, stem from things that feel very indebted to Dream Warriors. Uh-huh. You know, the kids working together, the kids caring about each other.
Yeah.
And they are likable kids.
Yeah.
They're likable teens. They stick up for each other. They talk to each other. There's, I think, a more natural chemistry between this group than maybe some of the later entries.
Well, that's interesting because I remember from the Never Sleep Again documentary, I feel like they kind of said the opposite. Yeah. In fact, I thought it was pretty fucking savage how they talked about Kristen being recast. And they were like, oh yeah, this new chick, she just didn't have it. It was like,
oh, I'm not talking about like the first three who get killed off, but like
the
characters who are actually in the film and the main victims in this one.
Mm-hmm. And also we're dealing with, like, you know, Nightmare 3 had these kids in an institution and they had problems and Freddy was preying on their problems. In Nightmare 4, he's preying on their hobbies. He's preying on their lifestyles, on youth culture, exactly, which Renny Harlin, like, he wasn't like grandpa being like, this is what the kids are doing. That's what the kids were doing.
Yeah. And I think it plays a really fine line at the time, because as a kid, if you're savvy and kind of with it in 1988, you are starting to notice that your cultural interests are being sold to you. Mm-hmm. They're being commercialized and sold to you by something like MTV. And, you know, here's, again, this trickster character that comes in and starts disrupting it, that makes fun of the girl who, like, wants to be thin and go to the gym and all of that, who's scared of bugs, that kind of stuff. I think it's satirizing a certain reality.
Right. I think that's bang on. All right. So moving on to The Dream Child the very next year. This one, for me, falls into the classic sequel pitfall of, well, we've milked this ugly cow of new victims. Let's get more into the villain's backstory. Because the more we remove that mask, the more layers we peel away, the better, right? Wrong. I can't think of a single horror sequel where an origin story has been more satisfying than the one already laid out in 3, Bastard Son of Those Maniacs.
And that's all you need to say.
That's enough for me.
I don't need to see it.
No.
I don't. I truly don't.
It was actually way worse in my mind.
I will say, just for total transparency, Nightmare on Elm Street 5 is my least favorite entry in the franchise. I had the hardest time watching it. Yeah. But if you like it, I think that's great. And I'm glad you like it. Not you, Andrea, but you, listener.
Oh, good.
Also,
because
you, Andrea, if you like it.
Well, no.
But if you like a movie, guys, it's totally cool.
I just, it was really forgettable and, you know, thirsty, you know, and you can tell when a film's just trying too hard.
Yeah, and so much of this film, I think, centers around, for me, when I'm pulling out a theme out of it, it centers around teen pregnancy.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, at the time we were recording, the Georgia ban on abortion came into law. So it's feeling like a little bit of a raw week for things like this. And certainly in the Never Sleep Again doc, they talk a bit about, like, yeah, we were trying to, like, deal with topics that teens were concerned about, with, like, teen pregnancy. And, I mean, while it's kind of mentioned, like, that she might not keep the baby, Alice, the character, is seemingly very adamant that she will keep this baby. And for me, watching this film, it felt so pro-life in a way, because when she begins to interact with this child in her dreams that's revealed to be her unborn fetus, it very much syncs up to that kind of pro-life notion of, you know, life begins at conception. You know, here's this, like, six-year-old kid with these huge bags under his eyes who's talking to you. It really complicates the notion of abortion.
And that's right.
So for full transparency, I am very strongly pro-choice, and I don't know. I feel very strange about this film. I feel strange that I didn't like it. And I feel strange that the politics feel so murky to me.
Yeah.
And I just feel sad.
Yeah.
You know? Sad because of all, like, the legislation that is in
World. Totally.
But I've also been just sad watching this film. I watched it before the legislation passed, and I was still like, ugh. This feels weird.
Yeah, it was kind of a really downturn. At least 4 was fun, whereas 5 kind of gets dour. And yeah, it definitely, you get the sense that abortion was only included for controversy's sake. You get the sense that Alice kept it because she's a good girl, because good girls are, according to Carol Clover, like, it's starting to get formulaic. It's starting to get really dry.
You know, and I think it is important to mention, so Nightmare on Elm Street 5 came out in 1989, as we mentioned, but there was a report that came out in 1987 that teen births were rising across the country, across America. And this was, again, under Reagan, and a lot of this, the spin on it, had to do with drugs infiltrating suburban areas, divorces, foster care, basically the weakening of these kind of American dream family values. And that the consumption of sex, drugs, and rock and roll were to blame on some level. You know, MTV was making things sexy, so kids wanted to have sex. But by the same token, the Reagan administration was dealing out huge cuts to abortion services, to health clinics, to sex education, to birth control access. I mean, you know, fuck, guys. I don't know what to tell you if you think a music channel is causing all of these pregnancies when you are denying sexually curious and sexually active teens the right to knowledge and protection and care.
Yeah. Human nature, like the most basic of survival instincts. You can't repress that and not have terrible repercussions.
Yeah. Now, I also think it's interesting that the nun figure of Amanda Krueger kind of pops up again in this one. Again, we're dealing with this kind of Christian mythology working its way into Freddy. You know, he's the son of 100 maniacs, but he's also the son of a nun. And it all just feels... I don't know. I feel weird about it. I feel weird about it. And I feel like people are getting angry at us for the way we talk about Christians. So
you think so?
We've gotten some comments.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, sorry about it.
Yeah, as I've said before, one of the best people I ever knew in my entire life was a deeply Catholic nun. But her aim was to help every single person she encountered, regardless of race, gender, sexuality, anything. And she did that.
Yeah.
So I have a great love for the ideals of Christianity. And I think if you're a Christian and you're practicing in a way that doesn't harm anyone else and doesn't prevent anyone else from living their life, then cool. That's great. They're a nice set of values to kind of mold your life around if that's what you choose.
That's right. And I feel like in a different episode, we kind of delved deeper into this. Was it The Exorcist,
like
where we really
Exorcist.
Talked about Catholicism? So yeah, if you're feeling like we're attacking Catholicism, I urge you to go listen to that, because I was raised Roman Catholic. I'm no longer practicing, but I do have a great respect. And I do feel like orthodoxy is really the enemy, the danger that we're addressing when we talk about Christian themes in Christianity. We're talking about, you know, the way that Christianity is used to oppress and repress people. And it's not across the board. It's absolutely not. It's a belief system that is ancient, and I think that's valuable, and there's a lot of good tenets to it. So so yeah, don't add us on that, please.
That's all I got in five.
That's just fine. So let's move on to Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. And I have to say that once again, from the Never Sleep Again documentary, this one was directed by Rachel Talalay?
Yeah, Talalay.
Talalay? There's another La, but if it's pronounced...
No, do your way. I'm questioning myself now.
Okay. Rachel Talalay, and she appears throughout this documentary, and this is a fucking long documentary that goes in deep for every single entry of the franchise, and she was there all the way through. She was talking about what it was like on set for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you really get the sense that she pretty much said to Robert Shea, hey, I've been around.
I paid my dues.
I'd really like to direct this one. Can I direct this one? And they let her. And so I feel like that's, once again, a triumph. It's the first female director of this franchise, and...
The first and only.
And it seems like a gift to her, and she seems like she was so invested in it, and this production, she used John Waters' crew, Divine was supposed to be in it, there's tons of cameos in this, it's not a perfect film, but it's a very fun film, and you can tell when a film is made by a fan. And I really see that strongly through here. So this film does have some heart where I can't give it other merit.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to mention that the other kind of competing script was developed by Peter Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Who at that point had done Dead Alive and would go on to do the Lord of the Rings trilogy for New Line.
Right, but that's post-Shay and New Line, right?
Yeah, but I thought his idea for the film was really quite interesting, about how Freddy's become so weakened in the dreamscape, kids are now taking sleeping pills so they can go beat him up. And then all of a sudden he manages to kill one of them and everything starts to turn.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting concept, but they went with this one for Freddy's Dead, and I rewatched this about a year ago. Again, rewatching it for this episode just this week. I don't hate this film. I simply don't. I know a lot of people do not like this film. They think it's too camp, it's too funny, it's too this, it's too that. But I think it does a really good job of world building mm-hmm. and creating a tone and sustaining that tone mm-hmm. throughout the film. Whether you agree with it or not, I think especially for a first-time director, you can tell that Talley had investment, experience, and had a very clear vision of what she wanted. And I think it's funny. I think it's funny when it is supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
And I think it actually is probably my favorite performance of Robert Englund's.
Oh, wow.
Maybe following the first one. Uh-huh. Because he's, like, actually having to act.
Okay.
He is actually having to do things rather than just be menacing and brandishing the glove.
Right.
He is doing things within this mm-hmm. film. And I personally just love the scene and the ideology around this town that has been abandoned by children.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not abandoned by children, because is void of children
mm-hmm.
because of Freddy. I think the scenes like the fair scene where Roseanne Barr and Tom Arnold show up and then the school scene are so, I just find them very affecting.
Mm-hmm.
There's something so nihilistic about that. I mean, you know, possibly because one of my favorite films is Children of Men, and I find that concept of the death of youth
mm-hmm.
so fascinating. And you know, that's what Robert Englund has said in multiple interviews, is that Freddie wants to kill children because there is no future for him, so mm-hmm. he wants to destroy the future.
Right.
So I think in terms of that that notion, that thematic notion, this is a really clear vision of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. It's not my favorite film in the franchise. It's not in the top three. But I do feel like it has that heart that comes through. It has that evenness in the filmmaking, like you said. And I almost feel like it's got a bit of meta in that it's like, we're grasping at straws, and why hide it? Let's just have fun with it. Let's just lean into the camp, and this is the last one. Let's just go balls to the wall.
And keep in mind, like, at this point, Nightmare on Elm Street 4 was the highest grossing in the franchise, and then 5 came out, and it was the lowest grossing of the franchise.
Right.
So New Line had to shit or get off the pot.
Yeah.
So they swung for the fences,
mm-hmm.
and they took a risk, and I admire that.
I do, too. And it seemed like a really fun shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it didn't result in the greatest film of all time, I think this was a case of New Line really, truly thinking that they're saying goodbye to this character and sending him off in appropriate fashion.
And I think it was also acknowledgement of a film studio realizing that this character had kind of outgrown and outlived this franchise.
Yeah.
It was an acknowledgement that, okay, Freddy is no longer scary.
Yeah.
This cash cow is tapped out.
Yeah.
Let's try one more time and see what we get.
We can make more money on toys anyway. Fuck this.
Wait till they hit the convention circuit.
Oh, boy. So, with the end of the franchise, with Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare in 1991, we're going to go ahead to 1994, where Wes Craven came back to the franchise that he began with Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And this is one of the films that we decided we're going to dive a little bit deeper on. There's a lot to talk about because this film, just like Nightmare on Elm Street, it kind of launched a subgenre in its own. It had a tremendous impact in horror. So let's get into that. Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Coming from New Line Home Video, the $20 million box office smash. From Wes Craven, creator of A Nightmare on Elm Street, comes a new dimension in terror.
Miss me?
Cut the effect!
The bad man's getting awful close.
Wes Craven's New Nightmare. The best horror film in years.
Almost there.
The most twisted scare fest in ages. Four stars, the New York Post. Wes Craven takes it to a new dimension, raves the New York Times. New Nightmare reunites the stars from the original, including Heather Langenkamp, John Saxon, Nick Corey, and Robert Englund.
Ever played in the pack.
Wes Craven's New Nightmare. This time, staying awake won't save you.
Meet your maker.
The film opens on what appears to be a movie set for a new Nightmare on Elm Street franchise film. Heather Langenkamp is there, along with her FX artist husband and young son Dylan. Suddenly, Freddy's claw comes to life and, to the shock of the film crew, starts burying its blades in anyone nearby before taking aim at Heather's son, and then she wakes up. And the opening scene sets the stage of New Nightmare's meta-narrative, in which actress Heather Langenkamp starts experiencing the terrifying dreams and real-life murders that plagued her franchise movie character, Nancy Thompson. Director Wes Craven has been working on a new script, and as the specter of Freddy Krueger moves closer and closer to endangering Dylan, Heather realizes that she has to step into that role one more time and finish Freddy off for good. After a final showdown with the dream demon in his nightmare netherworld, she discovers a script that foretold the whole tale as if it were another film in the franchise.
Now, we talked a little bit about this movie before we started recording, and I really love this movie.
I knew it!
And the reason I love it is because of the role that Heather has within it. And I think it's a very interesting journey for her as a kind of pseudo-survivor. And I think as a young woman who watched this film and now as a grown woman watching this film, I think often we are called upon, anyone, man, woman, anything, we are called upon to be heroes at very different times in our lives. Mm-hmm. And we are called upon to stand up for ourselves and stand up for ideas and to protect people and protect the things we care about. And I really respond to the notion of her having to play Nancy one last time. Mm-hmm. And I got a little chill even just saying that. I think there's something very empowering about that narrative. I do not think it is a perfect film at all. But I, again, like Freddy's Dead, I respond to it in the way it kind of swings for the fences and in that journey of a young mother just finding her way through this and having to take a stand and having to stand up and fight back. I think there are some really, really interesting moments within the film. I love that John Saxon is some sort of like parental coach.
Yep.
Like, very why paternal would you, figure. Why would you go to him for like child rearing advice out of anyone? I'm not saying John Saxon's a bad guy. I just love that he's that kind of character.
Well, he was a lousy father in the first film, but he seems like a much better friend.
Yeah. Oh, God. Dylan's misbehaving. I'm going to call John. He'll know what to do.
I will give you that. In looking at this film in retrospect, I don't like it. I don't enjoy. I found it very frustrating. It kind of put me in a bad mood. I remember I was watching it with my partner and I was getting snippy at him and he was like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, I don't like it. But what I do like about it and what value I can pull out of it, apart from its meta-cinematic aspects that we're going to get to in a minute, is how it positions Nancy. I'll never be able to give myself over to the whole mom of a little kid in peril thing.
Yes.
The kid who plays Dylan was in Pet Sematary and he was amazing. In this film, I find him unbearable.
Yes.
Unbearably irritating to the point that, like, I'll take the kid and Babadook over this any day. And it's just not my jam. And I wasn't touched at all by his God doesn't want me bullshit. And I feel like there's an arrogance that runs through this film that Wes Craven is like, oh, man, they really did my franchise wrong. Here's my chance to right that wrong. And this film is going to be so much better. And it's really not. And he takes a lot of digs at the rest of the franchise that I'm just kind of like, can you sit down? But what I did find really interesting was that we've got Heather Langenkamp still doing publicity gigs about Nightmare on Elm Street. And you see her experiencing stigma for being a horror actress. And that's actually something that I can relate to right now as somebody who works in horror. And, you know, I'm so immersed in this lifestyle. It only occurs to me that it's weird when I'm talking to normies or when I'm trying to cross the border. I feel like those are the only circumstances where I'm like, I'm a magazine editor about genre film. And maybe I don't play the horror card because I'm afraid of that same stigma. And here we've got Heather Langenkamp. She's unable to prevent Dylan from seeing the movie. And the doctors blame her for his condition as a result. And then there's also the stalker fan, which was something that really happened to her. Yeah. And so I found that verite, that was the most affecting part of this film for me.
Yeah, I think when you get into Wes Craven talking about how this like ancient demon really loved the role of Freddy, it's like, yeah, no, we get it. we get it. But to, you know, that point, I don't know if there was another way around it. When I think one of the really smart things about this film is it doesn't try to keep aging itself down. Mm. I think by the time you're reaching Freddy's Dead and you're still, you know, creating the protagonists or some of the protagonists, even though the kind of main final girl is a therapist, you're still centering it around these teens. Mm-hmm. So I think it is smart to age up this film a bit to a woman, probably Langenkamp would have been probably, what, early 30s?
Yeah.
When this film was made. And I think that you want to grow with your audience, or you have to try. If you're going to stay stagnant and keep repeating the same thing, I don't think it makes as much sense.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree. I don't know if I agree with, like, Freddy kind of having this longstanding grudge. Again, like I said, I just can't. The mom in peril is less meaningful to me than a teenager who has no idea what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely I share that sentiment that I can't relate to a mother who has a child and is striving to protect that child. I think I just came into this film in a different way.
Do you think it's because we're not mothers, though? Because, like, motherhood is another thing that sometimes listeners come at us with. Like, don't slag on moms.
I were not. But neither of us have children. And I don't know, I kind of take out the child part of this movie.
Yeah.
Except for the end of it, which we'll talk about in a minute. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, it's just about a young adult woman mm-hmm. having to pack on that armor again mm-hmm. and be brave again and do this thing that she has been kind of rejecting mm-hmm. since she was in the first film, since she was in the third film. She's kind of, I'm Freddy's dead. Okay, let's, you know, I'm doing other stuff. There's other stuff going on. But she has to take on that mantle of a final girl again. And for me, someone who really responded as a kid to the final girl, it's still something I really respond to.
Oh, yeah.
So if I take the kid out of the equation, which I tend to do with this mm-hmm. film, I can create a narrative for myself within it that is like, yeah, you know, I'm still dealing with issues, and in my early 30s, I can respond to that need to armor up again.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I agree with that. And like I said, its influence on meta cinema, like, this is Wes Craven's jam. This is something that he went on to really perfect with Scream. I think Scream is really the ultimate depiction of this kind of meta narrative. But he tested the waters here. He tried some things.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, as Wes Craven has done, that Kevin Williamson is the writer of Scream. Uh-huh. He's so hugely important to that. And there's a really great article on BuzzFeed that we will link in the show notes called How New Nightmare Changed the Horror Game by Lewis Peitzman. And Craven is quoted throughout the article talking about how, you know, there are some parts that seem really self-serving. There are definitely some parts he do differently now. There are some parts that really work for him. Mm-hmm. But that what they were doing was being reflexive within their genre, within mm-hmm. their kind of scope, within their industry. Whereas when he got to Scream, it was making the audience the reflexive action mm-hmm. in it. So the audience was putting that layer on it. If you were going to engage with Scream, you were going to have this kind of extra experience with it.
That's right.
Whereas the reflexivity happens within New Nightmare.
Right.
It's kind of creating a new dimension within a fictional dimension.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and for whatever you have to say about his creative output, he is definitely one of the genre's more brainiac filmmakers. He's very thoughtful. He doesn't make decisions willy-nilly, whether or not I always agree with them. And I think his career trajectory largely mirrors that of Heather Langenkamp, in that he tried to do other things, but once you're a horror guy, you are the horror guy. And that's something that you're not going to be able to just walk away from.
Until you make Music of the Heart.
Oh,
no. Hey, Meryl Streep was in it. Yeah.
I love her.
That is his truly most terrifying film. But let's talk about meta cinema, reflexivity. Let's break that down a little bit right now, because we're throwing it around. And I feel like a lot of you guys out there definitely have a sense of it, or what it is, or how it kind of intersects with what we're talking about. But there is a really great article. It's on JSTOR, but we'll link it again in the show notes. Hopefully you guys can access it if you are really interested. And it is called Meta Cinema, A Modern Necessity, by a guy by the name of William C. Siska. And he basically posits meta cinema as something that is reacting to itself, and that cinema is a relatively new art form, something that really came about truly in the 20th century. It is the most apt to kind of deal with a meta-ness, something talking about itself, something mm-hmm. responding to itself. Of course, there is theater that responds to itself. One of the most famous examples is Shakespeare's Hamlet, mm-hmm. Where they're doing a play within a play to catch the conscience of the king. There's literature that has to do with writing books and all of that kind of mechanics behind it. But for Siska, meta-cinema is truly the most kind of modern, utilized take on reflexivity. So reflexivity in this case is an artist reflecting upon their medium and or an artist as creator reflecting on themselves. Mm-hmm. And what I think is interesting about New Nightmare is it's doing both. It's drawing back the curtain to see this is how a film gets made. Here are the guys who like do some of the effects. But also Wes Craven portraying himself, Heather Langenkamp portraying himself, Robert Englund, all of those people mm-hmm. showing up as themselves and then kind of having a duality. And particularly Robert Englund playing himself as this kind of like erudite, cool guy. Who then mysteriously leaves LA. But also then playing Freddy. Mm-hmm. And again, going back to Siska, a lot of meta-cinema is about showing the process and the presentation of filmmaking and how a construction of narrative happens. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me that within this film, the narrative is kind of parallel to the action. Mm-hmm. It seemingly has already happened, but is also about to happen. Mm-hmm. There is a tension between who is really in control.
That's right. The script is writing itself
exactly.
as it's happening,
and
word for word.
I love that we don't know the answer
to
that. It's not that Wes Craven is something. He just seems to be this median where everything is coming through him.
Oh, yeah. And for a franchise this tired, that was a really – it needed a fresh, fresh take, and this is as fresh as it comes.
Yeah, and it needed to be unformulaic. Mm-hmm. So it needed to put in these questions. It needed to posit these questions so that us as audience members watching it would have questions. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen next? Who's going to show up next? What is their role going to be? And for Siska, one of the things about meta-cinema – is that it is an attack on our kind of traditional mode of being an audience member, in that it attacks our empathy by undercutting the characters we are meant to identify with and care about. And for me, I think that's really the most obvious in Heather, because we know as audience members that Heather Langenkamp, the actress, played Nancy Thompson, but we are watching Heather Langenkamp play herself responding to Nancy Thompson. Mm-hmm. And so we're having these kind of degrees of removal. And I think the journey of the film, if it's successful for you, is about accepting this new version of Heather Langenkamp. Mm-hmm. She's not just an actress. She's not this person who played this character and this character interacted with this fictional villain. Mm-hmm. She is a real person dealing with a real villain.
Yeah.
And I think it's very challenging to consume. And I think if you maybe don't respond to it as much, there might be a bit too much distance. But if there's something that clicks for you, you might start to respond to it a bit more.
I feel like horror is very unique in the way it venerates and engages with its stars, is that when you become a horror icon, and indeed this is the case for Heather Langenkamp, you start doing the convention circuit. You start talking to people, and so they have a sense of who Nancy is, obviously, but they also have a very strong sense of who Heather is. And so I think for this film to kind of take that step back and address these two superstars as they are both real people, I think that's something that only the horror genre can really pull off.
And I think it was also really well set up. One of my favorite scenes in the film is when you're alluding to very early on in the film when she shows up to the talk show.
Mm.
And they're kind of grilling her. They're poking her. You know, do you let your son watch these films?
Yeah.
All of that. And then Robert Englund pops out as Freddy in his traditional makeup and kind of does a song and dance. And, you know, the audience gets all riled up and they're cheering for Freddy. And then Craven kind of pulls the camera back so that Robert Englund's back as Freddy is to us, the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And he's waving his hands back mm-hmm. and forth. And you're kind of in this weird hypnotic trance and you're seeing this commentary on what has been created.
Yeah.
That there's this villain that people are very critical of towards Heather. But yet when he shows up, everyone's like, rah, rah, rah,
everyone
Freddy.
Everyone loves Freddy.
And then I think what was really smart, and this is something that I wrote about quite a bit in my book on 90s teen horror, is Craven tends to be very careful in reframing a moment like that by reframing the kind of secondary cut to the protagonist's face to see how they are reacting.
Yep.
So in that moment, it goes from Freddy waving his hands to Heather's look of kind of confusion and just like she's taking in something a bit different this time. She's seeing through something a little bit more. There's something different about this.
Yeah, I took that moment as kind of irritation. Like, she was already wound up going into that appearance, like, oh God, I have to talk about this again. Yeah. It's from ages ago. She's getting harassing calls. There was this earthquake. Like, she's already kind of flustered. And I think in light of the fact that she wasn't expecting Robert Englund to be there and that cut from behind him, I just took it as her being like, I'm the fucking hero. This was my gig, but I'm always going to be in your shadow. Mm-hmm. You're always going to be the superstar, the star of the show. It actually reminded me of Salem last year.
Oh.
Do you remember? Oh, maybe it was 2 years ago, where Larpar Lincoln was there, and she did an appearance, and fucking Kane Hodder showed up. As I recall it, she wasn't expecting it. Is that true? Am I remembering that accurately?
No, I think there was something like, so Larpar Lincoln was the lead, I believe, in Friday the 13th, part 7, the kind of Carrie-esque one.
Yeah.
So she had the psychic abilities. So she was there as part of the appearance. Kane Hodder was also there. And I believe that after the screening, they were both going to get up on stage and be like, hey, it's us. We were just in that movie.
Right.
You saw. Yay, yay. And then Kane Hodder wanted to have a bit of a, like, moment.
Right.
So they put Larpar up first.
Right.
And then Kane Hodder came from the side and was like, fuck this bitch, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
and
kind of
had this, like, Jason-like machismo entrance.
Exactly like this. And I felt like exactly like this. It totally shifted the focus. Everyone, like, the Q&A that was about Lar became about Kane.
Yeah. It was definitely a strange moment.
It's a strange phenomenon in horror, though. Like,
but also, if I may say, to starfuck a little bit, Larpar Lincoln is a delight.
Oh, she's the shit.
She parties.
Yeah.
Like,
she parties like all hell, and she gives back to the community. Yeah. She's like, she's educating women. She's all about helping women navigate the perils of Hollywood and make sure they don't get taken advantage of. And I loved hanging out with her. Mm-hmm. She's great.
I still have her business card in my wallet.
Do you really?
Yeah, I look at it all the time.
I feel like horror, and again, I feel like this is a weird insider thing that I'm kind of desensitized to because we go to so many conventions and we see people dressed up as the horror villains, and I never really think of that as an endorsement of, like, you can't really dress up like Nancy Thompson. You know what I mean? So I almost feel...
Well, if I didn't blow dry my hair, I'd be very close.
If I let my grays come through?
Yeah.
It's more fun to dress up and to embody the character of the killer, but that's not to say that you're aligning yourself with the killer versus her or denigrating her performance in any way. Like,
no.
To celebrate the film is to kind of celebrate its villain. That's just kind of how it is.
They're the consistent thread.
That's right.
They're the consistent thread throughout the whole thing. You know, there is a reason why we call them icons, the icons of horror, icons of culture, because they are synonymous with certain things. A scarred face, a razor glove, these things are so synonymous with Freddy Krueger that I go, Nightmare on Elm Street, it all kind of ticks into place so quickly. So if you are a horror fan out in the world or going to a convention, whatever you're doing, it's kind of like the secret handshake.
That's right. Everyone knows who it is and what you're about, and you love the film.
Where if I'm going out there with, like, my frizzy hair and a pink sweater vest...
Then you're just Alex.
Or I might look like a Gap employee. I don't know. I think what's interesting about meta-cinema and what Siska kind of ultimately gets to is that what it is trying to do at its best is return to the personal root, return to a form of subjectivity. So the world is a personal experience rather than a kind of omniscient experience. And I think this is something we're seeing a lot more in horror, like kind of contemporary horror, where the status quo is being challenged. Things are being challenged in different ways. Different voices, more diverse voices are coming to the table. And so this kind of line of thinking led me on to someone who I studied briefly in university, and it was fun to go back to him for this, a guy by the name of François Lyotard. And he, obviously a French philosopher and theorist, wrote a book, a short book called The Postmodern Condition, where he talks quite a bit about the grand or meta narratives that society is built on.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be anything from the Enlightenment to manifest destiny, things like that. Things that a society and a culture are built on in order to keep everyone kind of in line. So the American dream, whatever your kind of grand meta narrative is, your actions in your personal life go to kind of serve this greater good. And you are inadvertently, it is a form of control because you are maintaining a status quo. But where these kind of grand meta narratives become problematic is that they're often corrupt. Or corruptible. You know, you look at 1930s Germany. That was a grand narrative that was horrifying.
Yes.
And so what Lyotard posits at the end of this book is that the real strength, like Siska, comes from the personal and the individual. And for me, what New Nightmare does is it kind of reclaims the Nightmare franchise a bit from Freddy, makes him the kind of true evil, the big bad, and then pulls it back to Nancy, who can defeat him. And, you know, you watch the film, and I've seen this film so many times, there is so much screen time given to Heather Langenkamp that Freddy only appears very briefly, kind of scattered throughout the film. And I think that makes him, A, more effective, more scary, but he is no longer the hero. I think we as an audience align ourselves so much more with Heather in this film. And again, that's part of my, like, feminine rah-rah response to this film.
Yeah. Fuck, man. I wish I had that.
I know. That's okay.
I feel like there's a lot of Heather doing stuff in slow-mo and Heather falling and Heather this and that, but and maybe the lack of Freddy is kind of my problem. I also didn't like... I didn't like his bio claw. I didn't...
Yeah.
There was so much that I just couldn't get behind.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we look at this film in terms of the ending of this film and what is different about the ending of this film versus all of the other franchise entries, and, you know, I can't say I'm the biggest fan of this, particularly in light of our discussion just now, but it is Dylan. It is her kid. Yes, she goes down to this underworld to save him, but it is their, you know, quote-unquote teamwork that helps them to stop Freddy. And Nancy slash Heather's badassery that kind of finally seems to shut this thing down.
Fucking barf. Sorry.
Because, well, no, because Freddy tries to sublimate Heather for Nancy.
Yeah.
He tries to disregard any kind of notion outside of Nancy because he needs to defeat Nancy. What he does not realize is that Nancy is actually Heather, and Heather has this full, complete life that she is willing to fight tooth and nail for.
Yeah. Right after she shoots out of his mouth into a... I cannot.
Believe me, my biggest problem is I like the thematic ending of this film.
Yes.
I think the ending of this film, particularly that fight sequence in his, like, lair thing, underworld, I don't know.
With the tongue?
Yeah, it wasn't well done, and it's too easy because when you set up a film to this scale... The ending's just too easy. You need to have something, something more than just a fight where they burn him.
Yeah.
You know? And, but I forgive that in this film because I like so much else about it. I like the buildup of it so much that I am willing to forgive it, but I totally understand that a lot of people are just like, no. And that weird CGI where his head explodes and like transforms into something else at the end, that was not good.
So moving along to the actual Final Friday, or the Final Friday as of yet, or actually not even, because I'm forgetting about the fucking remake.
And also, you might not consider it a Final Friday.
No, you shouldn't.
But you might? I don't know. I consider it part of the franchise.
Yeah. We've taken it too far that I can't edit that out. So let's just keep going with it. We're fast-forwarding to 2003 with Ronnie Yu's Freddy vs. Jason.
Die! Go to hell!
Freddy
versus Jason.
Place your bets.
Taking place in the present day, 2003 that was, Freddy Krueger has become inert and irrelevant since the residents of Springwood have largely forgotten about him and his crimes. To regain his power, he enlists the help of fellow immortal slasher Jason Voorhees, who arouses enough panic and terror in the neighborhood to bring about Freddy's return. Sure enough, Freddy becomes jealous of Jason's body count, and the teenagers caught in the middle are able to hatch a plan to drag Freddy out of the dream world and into reality so that the slashers can fight amongst themselves. The battle culminates in Jason being stabbed and Freddy being decapitated, but Jason rises from the lake the following morning and Freddy's severed head gives a cheeky wink, suggesting that he's still not dead. Cue the new metal. Dun-na, 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 dun-na.
On tour this summer, Faculty of Horror.
Yeah, no, okay. For 2003, it's the 90s-est. No, it's not. Nu metal is aughts.
Yeah, I mean, I always think of nu metal as when I encountered it with Limp Bizkit.
Oh, yeah.
This film had been so famous for not being made for so long that I think when it came out, we didn't really know what to do with ourselves. This is certainly the only Nightmare on Elm Street film at this stage that I'd seen in theaters.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I hadn't been old enough to see the other ones. So okay. This was my kind of first foray into seeing Freddy on the big screen. And I didn't really know what to expect. And before we get into the kind of production industry history of this film, I want to bring up something that I found so upsetting and just, yeah, there's no other word for it that I have at this moment, except for when I was watching the film the first time in the theater and it got to the scene where Kelly Rowland, who plays Kia in this film, she uses a slur against Freddy.
Yeah. It's shocking. It comes out of nowhere.
It was like, I still remember this feeling. It was like the loudest record scratch in the world. And I remember kind of looking around and being like, what is everyone else doing? And the interesting thing was no one else was doing anything. They weren't laughing at it. They weren't cowering. They weren't doing, it was just, I don't know. It just felt like a slap in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now this issue is being addressed more with this film. There are certainly a few more articles out there, including one by Trace Thurman, who's one of the co-hosts of the Horror Queers podcast, part of the Bloody Disgusting Network. So it was on Bloody Disgusting. We will link that article in the show notes so you guys can give it a read. And the writers respond to that moment within the film, as they do in the Never Sleep Again documentary, where it seems like the general consensus is that Rowland's improvised that line, and then through multiple people viewing it, through multiple edits, through multiple screen tests,
It got through,
despite the writers themselves saying, we didn't write that, please take it out.
They wrote something way better, from what I recall, right?
So they wrote it, essentially, that she was going to be saying what Nancy says to Freddy at the end of the first film, I take all the energy I gave to you back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But she's saying it to Jason, so it doesn't work. And then Freddy's behind her, and he goes, like, wrong one, bitch, and kills her. Way more
that
fucking interesting.
Yeah.
So for listeners of this film, or for my dear friends, one of whom is in this room, you will know my love of bad films.
Mm-hmm.
I love them. I love them so hard. And I feel like Freddy and Jason should have been one of those goofy, bad, fun-loving films. But for the longest time, I stayed away from it because that's all I could recall of it, is that slur. And the problem I have with it, and this is something we've talked about on this podcast before, which is, you know, misogyny, homophobia, racism, these things can all be at play within horror films. That doesn't have to stop them from being in horror films. What the problem becomes is when they're made to look cool or made to look positive. So, you know, for me, like the example that comes to mind off the top of my head is Pascal Laguiere's Martyrs. People are like, that's such a misogynistic film. And for me, I'm like, I don't see that film making brutalizing women cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's portraying one aspect of life which exists for women, and it's showing it to me in a negative light. So I know, yes, this is a bad thing that is happening, but it's part of my existence in my reality, so I'm getting to see it on screen. The problem I have with Freddy vs. Jason is that Kelly Rowland, while she is playing a kind of vapid character, she's supposed to be having some kind of character development, but she seems to just be getting nagged by the nerd the whole time into being a better person. I don't know. But she's supposed to be one of the protagonists.
Yeah.
She's standing up to Freddy. She's going, you know what? No, you don't get to bully me.
And that builds up to a big courageous...
You don't get to be... what scares me.
That's right.
And she uses a fucking slur.
Yeah.
She uses a hate-filled slur.
Yeah.
And it makes me so angry. I'm so angry right now.
That is a critical miss for this film. It is a huge mar. And you're right. When people talk about this film, I feel like it comes up more than anything.
Yeah. And so I had stayed away from this film for quite a while, saying like, yeah, sure, it's fun. But I hate that slur. I hate the thing that she says. I hate it. And then, so I finally kind of prepped myself and I sat down and rewatched it the other night. And I just feel like this movie hates its characters. It hates them. It hates who they are. And I just, you know, the attempted date rape in the cornfield and Catherine Isabel's boyfriend, like, bullying her into sex or all that stuff. The nerd nagging Kia. I just was like, I hate this. I hate this, like, bro culture horror that is infiltrating my fun, dumb horror movie that I should be able to sit back on a hangover day and enjoy. And I'll give you the flip side to that one, which is one of my favorite hangover films, which is Alien vs. Predator. It's not a great film, but it's fun. Mm-hmm. And there's some really good performances in it. And, you know, people aren't terrible in it. So I had more to say about Freddy vs. Jason. I just needed to say that off the top because I did tweet about it the other night and some people were like, it's not that. And yeah, you don't have to think it is as upsetting as I find it, but just recognize that maybe there are some not cool parts of it. Someone was tweeting at me that it has been reclaimed by the girls and the gays, but I haven't seen that. And I think there are better films to be reclaimed by the girls and the gays.
Sure. By
I'm
the
very
girls?
Fired up about
is that
this,
not
I
us?
Know.
Are we not the girls?
Yeah, I don't reclaim this film.
Okay, well, you know, I feel like there have been so many moments in horror history where stuff like that has happened and I've had to grit my teeth and get through it. And you can't. There are epochs in horror history where throwing the baby out of the bathwater and that has to do with content and that has to do with figures like Roman Polanski and stuff. But in 2003, there is no excuse for that getting through. And even the fact that everybody kind of admits that it's problematic, but it still got through is to me egregious. And like I said, it's a significant mar on the surface of this film. Absolutely. There's no getting around that. For me, this film is a fan film. And I've been kind of turning that over in my head is that how am I going to articulate this fan film? Because fan films nowadays are coming out all the time. Everybody is making their own Jason Michael Myers film and putting it up on YouTube. And the fan films, these aren't filmmakers, these are fans. And so they're trying to replicate their perception of what the franchise is without celebrating what's great about it, in my opinion. That's my read on it. And that's my read on this film is that a lot of people see slashers as misogynist and hateful and homophobic. And it seems like these screenwriters who are largely just fanboys kind of leaned into that. And they're like, yeah, this is going to be exactly like that. But then when you go back and look at the films, you're like, no. Those films didn't make me feel icky. This one does.
Yeah.
Because you should know better. You're being self-referential now and you should fucking know better.
Yeah.
So I absolutely agree with that ick factor, that jokes like that do not land in this film at all.
But would we maybe like to talk a little bit, as I alluded to earlier, about the troubled development history of this film?
I would like to talk about that. I'd also like to talk about, like, you mentioned how anticipated this film was. And that's because this film was teased in, which one? Jason Goes to Hell. There was an indication that that might happen and it just wet everyone's lips. And that was a long time ago. That was before New Nightmare. So franchise stuff came out since then. And so everyone was like, when is this happening? When is this supposed to happen? And even now, if you were to Google Ensemble monster films, horror crossover films, as I did in preparation for this episode. Fans are always, always discussing who would win in a fight. Ash versus Pinhead, Chucky versus Jigsaw. Annabelle versus Chuck, like whatever have you.
Oh my God, I would love to see Chucky versus Jigsaw.
Me too. That's
pretty
good.
That would be so cute. They both get taken down by like a mutant palm.
Yeah. Palm?
Palm.
Palm.
A Pomeranian.
Oh, a Pomeranian. I was thinking of a palm tree. Fans clamor for this shit, and they always have. And this dates all the way back from Universal's classic horror era. Frankenstein was made in 1931. It was followed by Bride of Frankenstein in 1935, Son of Frankenstein in 1939, Ghost of Frankenstein in 1942, and so on and so forth, keeping the sequels in the family, so to speak. Pretty much what Nightmare on Elm Street 4 to 6 did, but that's an aside. And then in 1943, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. And this was a movie that, where its plot was pretty similar in that the two monsters were largely at odds and people were just kind of navigating this clash of the titans happening amid them, fighting one another so that the heroes can escape. And to be honest, I thought there were more. I'm not a huge Universal guy, but I thought that there were tons of movie mashups. I thought Dracula met the Wolfman, met the Invisible Man, met the Mummy. I thought there were so many just because horror fans talk about it so much. I thought there were more. What there are actually a lot of are the Abbott and Costello Meet These Monsters movies, which is the classic monster mashup comedy spoof. I think we talked about those a little bit in our discussion of Young Frankenstein, how Universal treats these clashes, and I thought there were so many more, but there really aren't.
Well, you know, Universal tried recently, but Tom Cruise fucked it up for them.
Oh my God,
we could have seen Johnny Depp or not seen him as the Invisible Man.
I would like to not see him ever again.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at Nightmare 6 where he gets hit in the head with a frying pan.
And I do kind of get this appeal. I don't know if I've said this on the podcast before, but when I moved into the Rue Morgue Manor and my partner moved in with me, I was like, all right, you know, like we are going all in on this horror thing. And I realize it's my passion and it's not yours and you're coming with me and I will indulge in something you love. What is something that I can become a fan of that matters to you? And he was really into MMA. Mm. And MMA stands for mixed martial arts, which is to say that a sumo wrestler could fight a jiu-jitsu expert, who could fight a karate expert, who could fight like whatever the fuck. And after I understood it framed in this way, I understood its appeal. And so now I'm into it and we watch the fights every weekend and it's monstrous and I could talk forever about that and I don't want to. But what I'm getting at is that I understand the fandom and I understand the appetite for these clashes. But at the same time, when we have them really in the flesh, they're kind of bound to disappoint.
Yeah, I think there is so much to conjecture about mm-hmm. when this gets hinted at. And different people and different articles and different documentaries will allude to one thing or the other that precipitated Freddy versus Jason. Mm-hmm. But the first clear indicator, as Andrea mentioned, is in Jason Goes to Hell, where Freddy's glove comes up at the end and takes his mask down to hell.
Right.
Now, there is a really, really great book that I bought specifically for this episode, and I am actually so glad I bought it because it is such an interesting read. And if you are interested in Freddy versus Jason, but if broadly you are more interested in the film industry as I am, it's a book called Slash of the Titans by Dustin McNeil, and it traces the entire history of trying to get Freddy versus Jason made.
Oh shit.
So it is like a chapter by chapter breakdown of all of the different iterations of each script draft.
Okay.
But it is really well done. It is put together in a way so you can kind of breeze through it or you can read more of the in-depth interviews. Yeah, it's just a very well done book. So, and it's not that expensive. So we will link it in the show notes. So if you are interested, hopefully you can pick it up. And I kind of took from McNeil's writing some of the basic premises or premise that started in all the different iterations of this script. And again, this has been in development since the 90s. Mm-hmm. And New Line was so keen to turn it over. And it was stop, start. But here we go. Here is a running list of some of the main plot points that threaded throughout several different drafts of it. So, one, cult resurrecting Freddy by impregnating a virgin. The virgin's friend resurrect Jason to fight him.
Oh, thank God that didn't happen.
Jason is put on trial and is given sleeping pills to combat his insomnia where he encounters Freddy. So in that one, you learn that Jason was an insomniac.
That's dumb.
This one, which kind of might be my favorite, just based on the description, is characters from Jason Goes to Hell and Alice and Jacob from Nightmare on Elm Street 5 try to stop a prophecy involving Freddy and Jason on New Year's Eve in 1999. It also involves the FBI. It also involves some time travel. It's bonkers, but that was the one I was kind of the most excited
for. Okay.
Another iteration. A psychic teen helps the police capture a Freddy copycat. Then she and her friends go to Camp Crystal Lake to party and take these sleeping pills where Freddy and Jason begin to appear and the line between reality and dreams is blurred. Another one, a grad student researching Freddy and Jason accidentally resurrects them. Another one, Freddy uses a pop star to attempt to slaughter thousands through a pop star dream concert. But Jacob, the son from Nightmare on Elm Street 5, gets Jason to stop them. So those were like the main threads.
This is the pedigree. These are the stepping stones that got us to where we are.
Folks. Yes. And what I will say is the draft that went to screen, which was written by Damian Shannon and Mark Swift, is probably the simplest of them all. And within those drafts that I was just mentioning, they're kind of different mythologies that were created. Like Freddy was a camp counselor at Camp Crystal Lake. Freddy was dating Jason's mom. So they were trying to get these characters to intersect at another level, like a level kind of through the films within their mythology.
Very fundamental level.
So within this book, I did pull what Shannon and Swift's rules were for their attempt at the script.
Okay.
They knew that a lot of other scripts had come before and that they'd gotten murky and weird and they just obviously hadn't gotten greenlit. Mm-hmm. So they kind of set themselves several rules for how to write this script. And this is pulled from a Fangoria issue, and it's Fangoria number 226. So, number one, the new story must be set in the fictional universe of the Friday and Nightmare film franchises. Two, the new story will remain faithful to existing mythologies, which should not be changed to suit present. Three, the new story's tone will be scary, funny, not campy, and absurd. Four, continuity must be maintained, meaning Freddy versus Jason should begin where the previous sequels left off. Five, all non-slasher characters should be new. Six, the new plot must come from Freddy and Jason and not a dream within a dream. Seven, the kills will be evenly split in the distinct styles of Freddy and Jason. Eight, the story should strive for a tonal balance in all meanings of the word.
Hmm.
There you go.
Those aren't bad rules.
And they're shockingly basic rules. They're shockingly basic. But the thing is they were getting all these different writers in. And again, fans of these franchises who wanted to play, who wanted this kind of fan fiction-esque, laudatory kind of story to happen. So they were putting all this stuff, like there's a cult that worships Freddy and they're called Fredheads. Like all of this stuff that is ingrained in it. And so the draft that was eventually made is by far the most simple in terms of how to bring these two together, what would make them fight, what would make them, you know, contrast against each other. The only thing I'm really, you know, bummed about from this kind of ideology of the story is that the notion of Pinhead showing up at the end wasn't able to be used.
Rats.
I think that I would have lost my shit.
You know, Pinhead is such a, I like that he is kind of an arbiter. Mm-hmm. You know, he almost has a bureaucratic role within Hell. And that would have been in line with the Hellraiser universe and both of these universes.
Yeah.
And I would have been quite satisfied with that. But I get why it didn't happen. Because you know what's a real bitch?
Money?
Yeah.
Oh,
money and rights. And when it comes to Friday the 13th, oh boy, what a mess with the rights. And so I have been interested in the story, in the history of Friday the 13th and its rights, because I know a lot of our listeners might remember a Friday the 13th video game that came out a couple of years ago that was gangbusters. It was so, so good. You could do anything in this game to get rid of Jason. You could hide from him. You could attack him. You could take the car if you found the keys and the gas. If you got to a working phone, you could call up Tommy Jarvis. Like, the nods to the franchise were bulletproof. They were great. It was so much fun to play. In fact, like, When it came out, the servers just crashed because everybody was playing the living shit out of it. It was a phenomenon. But guess what? Once again, there will never be any downloadable updates to this game because the rights are once again in flux. And I have the history in front of me. It is more of a Friday the 13th story than a Nightmare on Elm Street story, but it's an interesting story. So
I want to hear it.
Well, then here it is. So the best resource I was able to find about this story is a bloody disgusting article by John Squires in which he interviews Larry Zerner, who played Shelley in Friday the 13th Part 3, who you'll all recall is actually the one responsible for Freddy donning a hockey mask. Like, he was a very pivotal character. Anyway, he's an entertainment lawyer now. And so they interviewed him to talk about this franchise and what's going on with the rights. So here's what's up. This ongoing lawsuit is happening between director Sean Cunningham and the screenplay writer Victor Miller. He wrote the screenplay. He wrote an early draft of the screenplay.
Of Friday the 13th?
Of the original Friday the 13th. And that's where some of the murkiness comes in. Apparently there were a lot of rewrites. Apparently he's not quite as responsible for what wound up on screen as he says he is. Who knows? I am not commenting on that aspect. But Victor Miller apparently sold his rights to the script to Cunningham for under $10,000. When the franchise went on to make hundreds of millions of dollars through movies, video games, and merch, Miller wasn't entitled to any of that money. Later, in the 80s, he tried to sue the producers for a piece of the pie, and they actually settled out of court. So there's that. However, there is a provision in the Copyright Act that states that an author can terminate any transfer of rights they made after 35 years. That was added by Congress to protect creators in circumstances exactly like this. So Victor Miller sent a notice of termination to Sean Cunningham, giving them 2 years to work out a deal on how to split the money for future projects. So this wouldn't apply to the projects already completed. But they didn't come to a deal. For one thing, Miller's script underwent a bunch of rewrites before filming began, and Cunningham wound up suing Miller, stating that the agreement signed in 1979 was not terminable despite the Copyright Act. The lawsuit has been going back and forth in appeals since 2008, and that's why there hasn't been any more Friday the 13th output. That's why there hasn't been any Friday the 13th video game DLCs, which was enormously successful. That's why. And it's especially sticky when you consider that the first Friday the 13th is, like, Miller would only really be entitled to certain aspects of the franchise.
He can only be entitled to baby Jason.
Jason wasn't the killer in the film that he wrote, and he didn't wear a hockey mask until part three. So what we're fighting over here is this amorphous amalgam of a name, Friday the 13th, a character name, Jason Voorhees. Like, there's so much muddiness that I really don't see a clean resolution to this lawsuit anytime soon.
Yeah, and that makes sense because in my research, it turned up that basically Sean Cunningham could give the character of Jason Voorhees to New Line to use in this manner.
Mm-hmm.
But they could not use Friday the 13th in the title.
That's right.
So hence Freddy versus Jason. And it was always a kind of Freddy versus Jason titling.
Exactly.
Damn.
So if you loved Freddy vs. Jason and you're clamoring for a second one, you're going to be clamoring for a while yet. Maybe it's for the best.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Alien vs. Predator Requiem has its moments, but I don't know if we need a Freddy vs. Jason Requiem.
There's Alien vs. Predator. There's another mashup. I thought there was another one. I remember. It was Sadako versus Kayako.
Right, I saw that.
That was the other mashup I was trying to think of. So that was in 2016, and that was a crossover between The Grudge and The Ring, which tries to follow the same plot situation, only instead of the monsters just fighting each other, they kind of amalgamate into Sadakaya?
Jeez, you know, I saw that at TIFF. And I do not remember that film. I remember the promotional stuff. For
me
that
too.
Film.
Do you remember like, the hair?
Yeah, was it
clumps?
Sadako throwing out a pitch at a baseball game?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Oh, that was fucking funny.
I remember that there was clumps of long dark hair that you could find in the streets of Toronto, and it would have a hashtag on it. And if you took a picture and put the hashtag, you could win passes to it. And I remember finding one such clump downtown, and it was raining, and it was just like, oh my god, that's so fucking gross. But it didn't do much to save the film, from what I understand. Is it poo?
It's, you know what? It's pretty funny. I just really don't remember much about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a bit long, but.
Forgettable is better than enraging, I guess, in this particular case.
Yeah, there's some parts I remember enjoying.
Yeah. And when it comes to Freddy versus Jason, like, you know, I did enjoy that they touched on the elemental aspects. That Jason has a thing with water and Freddy has a thing with fire. So like, there was some thought put into it. And even, like, you know, as you're rattling off all those other scripts, there were considerations. As flawed as this film is, it's...
Well, and I think, you know, one of the most interesting things within Freddy versus Jason is when they're some of the characters in a mental institution. And it's like all the kids who remember Freddy are put into a coma.
Right.
So you've got that weird scene of all these kids who've just been, like, drugged for the rest of their life.
That was a super creepy scene.
Yeah, it's super creepy. It's super fucking interesting.
Yeah.
I want to know more about that.
And it worked. It subdued Freddy, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's why he's not coming back. It's
But, like, this notion of having to do all this stuff, and I don't know, I thought that was so interesting, and it didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
Except to just kind of say they've done this terrible thing. I think there was more of a world around that story than what was on screen.
Well, speaking of missed opportunities.
Our favorite topic.
Let's move along to the remake.
Oh, sure.
I didn't want to talk about the remake at all, and I didn't want to review the remake. The remake was the only Nightmare on Elm Street that I saw in the cinema.
Yeah, I saw it too.
As opposed to, like, rep cinema, like, showings. I feel like I've seen Dream Warriors 10 times by now. But I hated it. I walked into it kind of hating it. The trailers did not look appealing to me. And I was just like, you know, they really need to leave this one alone. Already, I could tell that Freddy didn't look good. I wasn't going to be able to get on board. Like, I already had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. And I hated it. And I promptly forgot about it. I never watched it again. And I never gave it a second thought. However, in doing research, in calling up Freddy Krueger on my JSTOR article search and combing through all the stuff that didn't actually have anything to do with Freddy Krueger, I came up with a Film Quarterly article that was talking about how the remake failed because it didn't apply the material to the political concerns of its era. Which is to say that all that 1980s family strife we talked about in part one, it was pushed to the sidelines. The parents in this film are often single. They lack any meaningful context or engagement with the kids. They're just kind of shadow puppets. The kids don't band together as tightly as the original Elm Street kids.
Well, it's because of all those micro-naps.
Micro-naps. And this writer, I didn't get down their name, but I will put it in the show notes for sure. The new Nightmare, it could have been set in the 80s, right down to a fucking Joy Division t-shirt. It didn't seem like there was much effort to situate it in 2010, except for some token Googling that happens at some point. And I think they call it, what do they call it? Shit, I should have written it down. It's not Google, it's another, like,
yeah, 'cause they couldn't
tech-sounding word. Anyway, so I read that and I was like, yeah, yeah, I didn't like this film. I didn't think about it that way, but yeah. But then I found another article.
Ooh.
And I tweeted about this article because they misspelled Voorhees. And you mentioned that you had seen it as well, so I can't wait to hear what you think about it. But this second article is called The Boogeyman of Your Nightmares, Freddy Krueger's Folkloric Roots by Kara Shimabukuro. And it was saying that A Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake, has some post-9/11 fears, suspicions of misinformation and disinformation. The lines between the good guy and the bad guy are less distinguishable. The threat is less direct. Stuff like that. Like, once again, Freddy lives on through people's knowledge of him. But here, it's about making the teenagers remember and relive their own trauma. Mm-hmm. Not discover what their parents did, but it's something that happened to them. And it's such a different kind of violation than the original.
Yeah, because the remake goes into much more explicit detail about Freddy as a child molester. And that's what these kids have to grapple with. There is a hint that their parents may have killed an innocent man
yeah.
by killing Freddy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's Nancy when she discovers the photos and it was like, no, he was deeply inappropriate with us.
That's right.
And so they are re-traumatized all over again.
Yeah.
And so it is less about the parents in many ways and the sins of the parents. And it's more about, to me, frankly, the trauma of this film seems so tawdry because they are fitting this incredibly complex, dark topic of violating children within a formulaic structure of a slasher And you guys know, I love me a slasher. This is no disrespect to slashers, but it did get me thinking about, can a formulaic film such as a slasher, something that is so reliant on tropes, properly articulate anything meaningful about deep-seated trauma? Mm. You know, I feel like child murderer, murder in general, murder of teens, murder whatever, that's kind of a pat thing. That is something we all fear. Mm-hmm. When we dig into trauma, it is something so personal, and it is so dark, and it is so unique. There are so many different circumstances and stories and things that lead people to these places that to situate it within a formulaic structure cheapens it. Mm-hmm. So that has always kind of been one of my big problems with this film. I kind of find it super unwatchable. Everything, the whole aesthetic of this film was like they watched one Tool music video.
Yeah.
And they were like, do that.
Yeah.
Cool. It's also oddly silly. The CGI is kind of wonky. So that
there's CGI where there doesn't need to be CGI.
No.
Like, I'm sorry, that thing of Freddy's face showing through a silhouette in the first, they did that with a fucking sheet.
Yeah. So the whole thing just looks and feels very cheap. Mm-hmm. And then when you're kind of supposed to come to this big revelation at the end where the audience is supposed to go, holy shit, what a dark motherfucker.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't ring as true.
No, it doesn't land. Absolutely not. We spend zero time with these kids getting to know them. They are not likable. They are not sympathetic or cool to each other. Everybody is really just kind of like floating around in this orbit of this story. There's no community. There's no connection at all. And I absolutely agree with you. And I do think it has to do with trying to impose really dark, heavy subject matter on a formulaic slasher. But in 2010, like, what even is a formulaic slasher anymore? We are well past the 80s. We've gone through that entire franchise and done that formula to death.
Mm-hmm.
So all I could think when I read this article was how good all this sounds on paper.
Yes.
And how it could have been a very dark, very complex, very upsetting take on a story that we've seen told a million times, but it shit the bed in absolutely every regard.
Yeah, I mean, and it was a commercial venture. It was done by Michael Bay's Platinum Dunes, which kind of got very famous for doing the Texas Chainsaw remake, and then went on to do
which is all right.
Yeah, which is pretty decent. And then it went on to do a bunch of other ones. And then I feel like around the time this Nightmare on Elm Street came out, people were like, enough, just shut it down. And again, I think we, as Andrew was saying, we have these characters who are lost. They don't communicate. It's this dank, dark film. But the film never wants to comment on that. It never wants to say anything about that.
Yeah.
So
is this a critique of the social condition?
Or
is
do
this...
you not know how to make a film?
Yeah.
Samuel Bayer?
There were times that I was genuinely confused. Like, are they dating? Are they friends? Are they classmates who are kind of friends? You know, like, there were things that didn't link
up. Andrea, it's just edgy as fuck. So maybe you're not an edgelord like all of the people who made that film, but I'm not a fan of this film. I think the Nightmare on Elm Street continues to struggle with this foundational aspect of who Freddy was as a human and how do they combat that. They tried briefly in 1988 with the release of Freddy's Nightmares, the television series.
Right.
And the premiere was about Freddy's trial, or so I thought until I watched the episode in prep for this.
Oh.
And it's about 2 minutes spent on the trial, and then Freddy gets let go, and then he's going to start killing again, and then the cop who didn't sign the piece of paper lights the match that kills him, and then Freddy in his dream stalks him. And it's directed by Tobe Hooper, so womp womp. I think it is this truly fascinating question mark about legal process, about culture, about small towns, about, you know, where this trauma is situated, that I don't think needs to be addressed. Because as we've discussed on this podcast, as we've discussed on this episode, the more detail you try to point out of something like that, the more specific and the more wonky it becomes. All I need to know is this guy got off on a technicality and the parents were so angry that they went out and they did something about that.
Well, that was the old movie. Like, I don't think these things don't need to be addressed. I wish they would be addressed properly. I think it's really compelling, the idea that in the modern context, it's wrongs that happened to the kids themselves and that they themselves were not aware of because of the mechanisms of trauma. Like, that is a very... now subject. Mm-hmm. And it's more now than it was in 2010, which is, I think, why when I went back, I was just kind of like, this could have been, this should have been, this should still be. I think there's still meat on these bones, and it's not going to be like the Nightmare on Elm Street that we loved, but kids today are facing way different nightmares than they were in the 80s, and it actually opened me up to the idea of an updated Nightmare.
I'm never against a remake. I'm never against a new sequel. I want to see what people bring to the table. I think it's just disappointing when it's just like they've got a poker and they're just going to poke the audience with this trauma.
I hate that.
Without ever saying anything about it or without ever paying it respect for the people
That's right.
who have gone through it
That's
and
right.
to experience it and live with it every day.
But in the right hands?
Oh.
This would be a movie that we'd be singing its praises until the end of time.
Absolutely. And I think, you know what? Not every remake is going to be Suspiria. No, it's true. But Suspiria took this core idea and articulated it in an entirely different way, whether you responded to it or not. It gave us something different. And it is something that resonates still with me deeply.
Oh, well, this film gave me something different. And it resonates with me, just not in the same way Suspiria does.
It was a poop in the mouth.
It was a massive poop in the mouth and a whole evening of nu metal. I know I told Alex this, but like after Fear Factory played in the closing credits, my partner was like, hey, I remember this album, and we listened to Fear Factory all fucking night. There's so much wrong with this film. Like, where to begin? It was tone deaf politically and narratively. There were such head-scratching decisions. Like, I mean, there was the micro-naps. Mm-hmm. The mere existence of the micro-naps is absolute nonsense. But then the idea of him having a micro-nap in a pool? Think that if there's anything, literally anything you could do that would wake your body up such that you could not fall asleep and drown, it would be fucking swimming. And then he has to witness that flashback in a Speedo. It's like, this is preposterous. Couldn't he be even playing basketball?
No, they couldn't. I don't know. I actually can't spend any more brain power on this film.
It's a super frustrating film, but I am glad I went back and rewatched it. I got more out of it than I thought I would. And maybe you will, and maybe you won't, listeners, but...
And maybe this is a film that you experienced, and it really did mean something to you, and that's awesome, and that's super cool.
Yeah.
We don't want to take that away from you. We just want something different from it.
That's right. And there's also something to be said of Nightmare on Elm Street exhaustion. You know what I mean?
Exhausted.
Like, I think the world was exhausted with this franchise after 9 movies. Alex and I certainly are after a 2-month deep dive.
But I mean, for something completely different, Andrea, would you like to tell all our lovely listeners about what our next episode is on?
Ooh! Our next episode is on a film. It's one of those films that I love that I feel like everyone else hates. Those are always really fun episodes to do because I always feel a lot of pressure to save it, to redeem it, to try and like...
Andrea, it's not a man.
No, but it's about a man. We are going to tackle the adaptation of Stephen King's short story, The Mist.
I'm excited.
This film has come up in my orbit a couple of times. Most recently, I guess, when we did that Black Museum debate on best Stephen King adaptation. It was a contender that I didn't expect to be a contender, and so I got to hear it defended and I got to hear it attacked. And I certainly have my own thoughts about it, and I'm really excited to discuss it with you.
Yeah, it's not one of my favorite films, but I think thematically it is so interesting. I think it is really bold. I think it is really brave. I think there's some really cool stuff in it, and I'm excited to revisit it and to think about it in a really in-depth way, which I haven't really done. So I think there's a lot of new stuff for us to talk about within that film and within that discussion.
Yes, indeed. But before we go, once more, the usual housekeeping announcements. Don't forget, the Faculty of Horror t-shirts are on sale now. They are not going to be on sale forever, guys. If you are waiting for whatever reason, if you're waiting for your tax return, your next paycheck, Class of 2019 t-shirts are going to be available for a short time left, and then they're gone for good. So pick those up. Do it now.
And then, of course, we are heading back to Salem Horror Fest. We are so excited. We will be there the weekend of October 5th. That is when our live show is. We're doing an episode for a live show on Under the Skin, which I think will be really exciting. And that same day, I will be doing a lecture on social media horror. Mm-hmm. So that will also be another fun, interesting thing that will be happening in Salem, Massachusetts.
I'm not preparing a lecture for this year because last year it almost killed me, but maybe there's something else we could do that's fun.
Yeah, you can plan a meetup.
Yeah, maybe if somebody knows of a karaoke bar, I can show you my pro-choice version of Papa Don't Preach.
You're absolutely going to get into the country. That sentiment.
And before we wrap up real quick, I want to give a quick shout out to Elliot Ingersoll, who sent us a book. He sent us a book about dreams, and he works in psychology, and he sent us a book to kind of inform our discussion. It's an aspect of the discussion that we did last episode and not this episode, so I wasn't able to address it. But I did receive the book. Thank you so much, Elliot. And thank you to all of our listeners. When you guys send us stuff, man, it warms my cold, dead heart.
And speaking of cold, dead hearts getting warmed, I want to publicly give a really big congratulations to you, Andrea, for winning Writer of the Year in the Mondo Awards. That was a write-in award.
It was.
Writer of the Year. That's huge.
Thanks, man.
And so well-earned and well-deserved, and it just brightened my whole week when I saw that. So congrats publicly for all that you do. I'm so pleased for you.
Thank you so much. That's nice. And on that note, let's wrap up.
I need some sleep after all of those movies. And I need to watch just one movie for next month's episode.
I'm looking forward to that.
Me too.
So until then,
office hours are closed.